Hello and welcome back to New Books in Latino Studies. I'm David James Gonzalez, the host of the podcast, and I'm joined today by Gabriel Thompson, author of America's Social Arsonist, Fred Ross, and Grassroots Organizing in the 20th Century. Gabriel Thompson is a Steinbeck Fellow in Creative Writing at San Jose State University. He is author of several books, including Walking in the Shadows, and has written for Harper's, New York, Mother Jones, Virginia Quarterly, and The Nation. Hello, Gabriel, and welcome to New Books in Latino Studies.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, it's certainly a pleasure, and I haven't told you this yet, but I'm sure you've heard from numbers, your book on Ross has been eagerly anticipated, I believe, by a nice few for some time, particularly those, aware of Cesar Chavez's background and other, Mexican-American organizations that benefited from his tutelage and mentoring. So it's great that the book is out and very excited to have you on the channel today.
Yeah, one of the things I quickly realized as I was beginning sort of these interviews with people for the book was that there was, I remember visiting with someone named Luis Gonzalez in Stockton who had worked with Ross in the 50s, and that was one of my first interviews, and he says, wait for a second, we're in the backyard in his patio, and he goes into his garage and brings out like a whole box full of documents about all the work he had done with Ross and with the groups, and so there were not only people kind of waiting to learn more about Ross, but there are a bunch of people who had sort of worked with Ross that were really excited to talk about him. So I was, I was lucky to stumble into the project.
Well, that's great. And I mentioned just very briefly, the little bio I posted here mentioned doesn't really do any justice. So I was wondering if you could start off our conversation by telling us a little bit, about your own personal background and, your professional background as well.
Yeah. So I started out not as a writer, but as an organizer. I grew up in California. Actually, my parents live in San Jose. I spent my last years in high school in San Jose. So it was interesting to learn, that Ross and Chavez met each other in San Jose, not far from my parents' house. But so I graduated from this really small school called the Johnston Center, which is on the campus of the University of Redlands, east of LA in the Inland Empire, and then went out to New York City and worked for about 5 years or so as a community organizer, working mostly with Mexican immigrants around housing, lead poisoning, evictions, those sorts of issues. And then after, at a certain point, I was really getting interested in the folks that I was learning about. Organizing in some ways is a bit like journalism, where you get to, you get to cross paths with folks that you might otherwise not get the opportunity to do so. And I became close to a cab driver in New York. His name was Enrique. And ended up kind of writing an article about him, and then ended up going back to Mexico with him and left my organizing job and wrote a book about kind of his journey to the United States and how he viewed his struggles in the U.S., but also his kind of triumph in the U.S. And that experience got me sort of down the journalism path of of writing. Most of my writing has in some way been about Latino immigration or working conditions or labor, or organizing. And so I've most of my work has been as a freelance journalist now. And occasionally I'll run out of money, or not that occasionally, I'll run out of money. And then I'll, go and do something else for a little while to have some more money to then lose money working as a journalist. but the Ross, I came to Ross sort of, it was definitely a subject that, it touched on many of my interests. He was this key organizer. He also I've always been interested in history, and he had a really important and interesting and kind of overlooked role in many different developments, in California, especially in the 20th century. So I was, you know, really, I was both excited to, once I realized, you know, for me, when I first came across the name Ross, I figured, oh, there's probably a bunch of books written about him, or I arrived too late. That's always like sort of like a journalist's constant fear. Is there going to get scooped by something? And I figured right. for this book that someone had certainly written about Ross, and I was fortunate to learn that no one had. So I was excited to do that, but also kind of not having a background in a formal background in history, and not having, you know, I enjoy reading biographies, but I certainly never hadn't thought about writing one before, really in a serious way. I was also a little bit anxious about, you know, what it might entail to try to do this book.
Right. And so can you tell us a bit more about what, you know, being a little apprehensive about perhaps approaching a biography or, you know, a subject like this, which merges both, you know, biography and involves a lot of, you know, historical research, certainly. What pushed you to actually pursue the project and do it?
Well, this was a while ago. It was the fall of 2007. And I was in Tucson in Arizona, and I was getting ready to move to Yuma, Arizona to work in the lettuce fields, as for a previous book, Working in the Shadows, in which I kind of spent a year doing jobs in industries that rely upon Latino immigrants. So I was getting ready to work in the fields in Yuma, cutting lettuce. And in preparation for that, I read the book, The Grapes of Wrath, which I'd certainly been assigned it in high school, but I had never actually gotten around to reading it, by Steinbeck. And I was struck by the Jode family. The moment their luck kind of changes in that book is when they arrive at this migrant camp in the San Joaquin Valley that's run by the government. And it's a place where they can kind of rebuild their lives, and the migrants run the camp themselves, and they have a democratic council. And I was really struck by that description of this camp in the book. And the next book I read was Salty Puedes, this kind of extended profile of Cesar Chavez, mm-hmm. by a New Yorker writer, Peter Matheson. And in that, it has this, Cesar gives this very dramatic description of how he got into the, became an organizer, and it started with Ross kind of knocking on his door and Cesar being skeptical of this white outsider in East San Jose, but then being won over and sort of training under Ross. And when I put that book down, I was immediately intrigued, and my intrigue kind of grew when I learned that one of Ross's first jobs after college was managing this migrant labor camp that was the same one that Steinbeck had visited when he was doing research for what became The Grapes of Wrath. So I think for me, once I realized that here was this figure who kind of connected Steinbeck and the Depression and The Grapes of Wrath to Cesar Chavez and UFW and the farm worker rebellions of the 60s and 70s, that was really intriguing. And then when I was working on another book, so I had the chance to let it just sort of simmer for a bit. You know, I would visit the Ross archives in Stanford whenever I came home to visit my family, because mm-hmm. at the time I was in New York. But, you know, I just kept accumulating documents, had a couple nice conversations with Fred Ross Jr., Ross's son, who introduced right. me to folks like Dolores Huerta, and I was able to get some key interviews early on. And at a certain point, I think it just, you know, it's like, okay, you know, this is happening. You go far enough down the path, and it's maybe it seems longer to backtrack than to keep going forward.
Right.
Although with what I learned is, in fact, usually, you know, biography, I don't know, maybe it's just history in general, but there's, for me, biography is, you know, it's a, you can see why some folks can spend 30 years working on a biography and they die without ever finishing it, because you're trying to learn as much as you can about someone, and there's always new things being revealed, you know.
Certainly.
Mm-hmm. So I think that was my kind of initial interest. Then figuring out there are some papers, you know, that he's got. There were places to go. You know,
it was, right.
I'm going to write this book about Ross. Well, his papers are at Stanford, and And, you know, they're huge. And he had written, he'd spent much of his life trying to write his book on organizing, and it had never been published. But, you know, there's hundreds of pages of his own writing. There's 444 audio tapes at Stanford of him giving trainings or being interviewed or just talking about stuff. So, you know, I remember my excitement the first time I went to the archives at Stanford and sat down, and it was the first archive I've ever been in, and kind of looking through these documents and seeing handwritten notes, and thinking like, wow, this is super cool. But then I learned that, you know, you go and visit all these archives and for me, and you come back and you're trying to tell the story, and it's like, wait, what the hell did I photocopy this thing? What am I looking at? You know, it can be hard to keep. If I ever write a biography again, I'll definitely be a little more systematic as I go into it.
Well, the finished product came out, you know, very nice, and I think certainly I bet it was a pleasant surprise walking into that Stanford archive and finding that treasure trove, if you will, on Ross. I'm very intrigued. First of all, the cover is great, and we're going to post a picture of it. It'll be on, you know, the website once this interview posts. So I believe it's a picture of, you know, a very young Ross. He looks like he's in or near an FSA camp. That's a Farm Security Administration camp, right? And that's Woody Guthrie standing next to him.
Yeah. It's a fantastic photo.
Yeah.
And you can kind of see, you know, Ross is still, he's still sort of muscled. He has spent much of his college years and high school years kind of working out. So you see he looks a bit like a movie star, and it's a great photo. And that was a period in Ross's life, I think, that was really, really critical to understand.
No, it really is. And the title's very catching. And to those familiar with Ross and his axioms, it'll be one that sounds familiar, but for, those of our listeners that aren't too familiar, maybe they know of him, but they don't know of his axioms. Will you explain where the title comes from? Title comes from that is,
yeah.
America's Social Arsonist.
Yeah. So America's Social Arsonist. His one of the definitions he had of an organizer was an organizer. A good organizer is a social arsonist who goes around setting people on fire. And so the idea. It's evocative. It's also kind of confusing. You know, if you it takes a little bit of backstory to figure out exactly what it means, social arsonist. But at the end of the day, you know, an organizer. You can't say there's one thing an organizer does, but you have to bring new people in. Mm-hmm. You have to sort of encourage people. You have to inspire them. You have to at some level convince them that they have more power than they might be feeling at the moment. And that was, whether you call it being a social arsonist or encouraging people, or that was, what was one of the things that was most intriguing about Ross is that he really had a way of it wasn't always that he had to convince people like Cesar Chavez or Dolores Huerta that there was a problem.
Right.
Because, you know, it was more like, okay, we all know there's problems, but, this is really a problem that's way too big for me. And Ross had a way of breaking things down and sort of, I think, explaining, potential paths forward that made people feel like, oh yeah, of course we can do that. You know, mm-hmm. It's of course. And I think that sort of confidence he was really skilled and worked really hard at getting people convinced in their own abilities.
Right. And I think the title too, it naturally, it's one of Ross's sayings, but I think it both encapsulates really the narrative as well that you tell. I think a number, those familiar with Ross are aware of the different Mexican-Americanist organizations that he, you know, helped either establish or helped grow and was involved in. But at least I wasn't aware of all of his work prior to, even his work in with some Orange County activists on the Mendez case. I found out some of that stuff when I was an undergrad doing some research, and then I later, of course, found out about his CSO work. But the pre-story, you know, is what you title in part one of the book. You know, the education of an organizer is just as much as, you know, all the stuff after, you know, the post-war period where he's, you know, involved with a number of organizations, all the work he has before, you know, during the war and during the Great Depression, jumping from various parts of New Deal programs and his education, as you will, is just as sweeping and breathtaking. So can you, maybe we can start there.
Sorry.
And we can.
There's Oakland, so there's a lot of sirens going around.
Maybe we can start there and talk a bit about first of all, let's talk a little bit about his family, just really quickly, because he seems, you know, from his background, I was definitely surprised to find out, you know, his parents' background, and that just from that, you would think he was really the unlikely, you know, organizer and activist that he came out to be.
Yeah, he grew up in both of his parents were conservative. He grew up in an all-white neighborhood, part of Echo Park, Los Angeles. He recalls both his parents referring to poor people as trash. His mom pulls him out of a grade school when he's young, when she learns that it has some black students in it. And so he really is not, you know, does not seem like the kind of person that's going to spend his life doing what he did. I think, you know, if you turn it, his turn to the left begins to happen at the University of Southern California, where he goes to college, and he meets one student in particular, a guy named Eugene Woolman, who was a Jewish kid from the East Coast, and who was just this sort of open communist, very kind of fiery and passionate, and, you know, kind of introduced Ross to the events that were going around. You know, there was bread lines, there were Mexicans being deported during the Depression, there was labor struggles, and I think more than anyone at USC, it was Woolman that really just kind of made the world pop a bit for Ross, and mm-hmm. took him out of his Echo Park neighborhood, and seeing sort of that the world is full of all these incredible conflicts, and that Woolman ends up going to Spain as part of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade and dying fighting against Franco and the fascists in Spain. And so that both his life and sort of his early tragic death played a big role for Ross. And it was something that in his papers, there's a kind of a hand scribbled. He had terrible handwriting. Mm-hmm. Ross did, and which made some things difficult for me. And people that spend time in archives will, you know, appreciate the pain that can be. But he had this kind of scribbled note. One of the first things I found was a list of his influences that he had written up maybe in his 70s. And you see Eugene Woolman right at the top. So he graduates from college, and he's, you know, sort of interested in the left, and in the progressive politics of the day. But the other important thing that happens is that he can't get a job teaching high school history, which is what he sort of has been prepared to do. And instead, because there just aren't very many teacher jobs, it's the Depression is going on, and he gets the only job he can really find is first handing out relief checks to poor farm workers in Riverside County. Right. Many of who are kind of Dust Bowl migrants from Oklahoma and Texas, and then graduates and runs this migrant camp that had been built as a kind of emergency response to all these folks coming into California by the federal government. And he manages the Arvin camp. It's the one that I mentioned that Steinbeck had visited a number of times. And that's, you know, I think that's really where he is thrust into sort of seeing day in and day out what it's like to sort of be working extremely hard and be earning extremely little for it, and sort of the forces that were organized against farm workers. And then also he's there when, you know, the Grapes of Wrath comes out, and suddenly the camp that he's running is, people are paying attention to it. You know, celebrities are coming to visit, politicians are visiting, Eleanor Roosevelt comes to visit, because the Grapes of Wrath has kind of put this story on the front pages. And a union calls a strike of cotton pickers, hoping to kind of use the, partly to use the notoriety and the new attention, the Grapes of Wrath, to win wage increases. And Ross is there. The camp that he's working is kind of like a stronghold for the union. And he sees folks sort of organizing, and he also sees folks kind of getting crushed. But I think that he refers to those 2 years that he works at that camp as his, some of the two most turbocharged years of his life. Because I think it convinced him, first of all, that he loved work. He was so curious about the folks, and he loved hanging out. He loved to try to get to know people and gain their confidence. And he just had this desire to listen to people. And so I think that those 2 years were really important in sort of setting him down the winding path that he would take.
Yeah, it. What interested me from that part as well, that his work with the New Deal agencies, the State Relief Agency and the Farm Security Administration, I think you cover those in chapters 2 and 3. And it seems that what had a really big impact on him was, to see how the democratic structure of the FSA camps worked or could work. And I think he saw good and bad examples of it. And then in the Arvin camp, he really tried to really improve that. And from those FSA council meetings, he wrote that he learned two things. And one you just mentioned, the need and to listen to people. And that's something, as you mentioned, he had a very genuine curiosity. But then he also learned, through listening, to take time to get to know them so he could really understand the issues they were dealing with. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. And it was a good sort of training or proving ground, I think, for Ross, because, although there were a lot of efforts to try to help these farm workers, these so-called Okies and Arkies that are coming in, there was also a lot of condescension, of kind of paternalism in treating them like they were totally incapable of managing their own affairs, or that, that the reason that they were dirt poor was somehow, something they had done wrong, not forces of nature or economic structures. And so there were, they were skeptical to some degree, at least some of them expressed this, of people coming in and treating them like children, or treating them as if they didn't have a brain in their head. And so Ross's approach of sort of naturally affording people dignity, or naturally assuming that they are, they're worth listening to closely, they're worth spending time with. He talks about when he first arrives at the camp. It's also a unique situation because the previous manager has been essentially kicked out by the residents. The residents had sent a petition. They'd signed more than 100 people to headquarters of the Farm Security Administration in San Francisco, accusing the previous manager of the camp, who is supposed to be kind of this, democracy builder in some sense, of doing any number of terrible things, violent acts. And so Ross was coming into a situation in which the folks at the camp were, I think, naturally skeptical of the managers. And so he worked really hard going tent to tent, kind of having long conversations with people. I mean, I think that, again, was good training ground. It's one thing to be kind of a person on the left and think that, poor people need to organize and that they tend to get screwed by rich people and whatever it is. It's another thing to be an organizer and really enjoy spending the time talking to people and listening to people. And I think at Arvin, it becomes clear that, he's not going to become a lawyer or a policy person or any other. What he loves to do is hang out with people and sort of help them think through their problems.
Right, and this seems to stem from something you write very early in the book, within the first dozen pages or so, which was that even as a child, Ross had a very keen fascination with those that seemed to be kept outside of, you know, society. And I think at the time you'd written that, it was in reference to some racial minorities that lived around him, African Americans in particular, that his mom wanted to steer him away from, that even as he would meander to take trips, I think it was to his grandparents' house, he would take a trolley and intentionally walk, you know, through neighborhoods or areas where he would see those people. You know, he'd see either African Americans or other, you know, racial minorities or, you know, people that were poor. And he was always seemingly curious or fascinated by that.
Yeah. It's always interesting, too, to think about how people decades later write about the formative experiences in their life, you know? And, mm-hmm. But he certainly, his parents tried to create, and especially his parents' divorces, he's never very close to his dad, but his parents divorced and he lives with his mom, from a pretty young age. And, I think there was just the kind of anxiety that his parents had and his mom had about, malignant forces or dangerous forces. And Los Angeles was also changing. It was becoming more diverse. It was becoming more of a center of Mexican-American life. And there was, the city that had been sort of boasted as being the all-American, you know, reed white city of the United States, sort of changes that were occurring. And so I don't know how much was just a natural, you know, when you're forbidden to do something, it becomes mm-hmm. much more interesting to you.
Right.
But I think he had just a kind of natural, I don't know how you account for this, but had a natural kind of democratic ethos, that there was mm-hmm. just nothing, as he got into the world and started meeting with people, there's nothing in his mind that made racism or making thinking that like one group is somehow better than another, or even, you know, what he sees with his own eyes and with his, you know, kind of in his own daily life, it's just kind of too powerful of an affirmation that, kind of like an anti-racist affirmation that despite what his parents say, despite what all these people, you know, are saying, despite when he's working in internment camps with Japanese Americans and there's all this propaganda against them, that he, when he's face to face with folks that everyone else is saying are somehow less than, it just doesn't make sense to him. You know, he just doesn't believe it.
Right. Right, certainly. And so we're talking about his time at the Arvin camp, and while he's there, he gets, you know, seemed to be, you know, also very interested and engaged in, the labor movement and labor organizing, and really supports the CIO, organizers. I think it was Luke Hinman that you mentioned that are coming into the camp and drive this, you know, cotton strike seems to make raise a big ruckus at the time. And so due to that, right, his strong support of the labor movements and the strike, his time at the FSA camp starts to phase out, and he secures a position with the War Relocation Authority and right around, you know, right just during the war. So you talk a bit about his experiences with that, with the WRA, in relocating Japanese interns.
Yeah, so they're looking for people. The government is, you know, hurriedly building these relocation centers to kind of round up people, ethnic Japanese, and then sending them from these relocation centers on the West Coast inland to internment camps. And it's all, you know, you look back at it when you're reading these documents, it's amazing how quickly this happened and how little debate there was, really. But so his first duty is to help. One of the problems that they face is that that the complications is that, you know, once the order is made that the ethnic Japanese need to be banned from the Pacific, from the West Coast, basically, so they can either move inland, or if they don't move inland, they can kind of begin this process of being forcibly relocated. The Japanese Americans are really skilled growers, and they've got all this land that's very valuable. And so one of Ross's first duties is to try to oversee the transfer. He's not making these policy decisions. He's just sort of a low-level person who's going. He gets assigned to San Diego, but the other FSA folks are in other parts of the state. But basically trying to transfer land ownership from Japanese Americans to mostly white growers who are buying their land for pennies on the dollar because, they realize that the Japanese are in no position to negotiate. They're being kicked out. And so that, I think, leaves he writes about seeing these lines of Japanese men just having their, totally bewildered and having their properties essentially stolen from them and not having any idea what comes next. But then once that process is over, he goes and sort of is assigned to run more or less community affairs at one of those internment camps, which is called Minidoka, and it was in Idaho. And like many of the internment camps, it's in this totally inhospitable terrain. And, more or less in the middle of nowhere. And he lasts there a few months. And he, at this point, I think early on, he was sort of went with the flow of the Japanese-American internment. He had come out of the New Deal agency that he thought was idealistic, the Farm Security Administration. He was a fan of Roosevelt. And so he had worked for the government for a while. And I think when the government made these statements about all these plots that were being hatched by disloyal Japanese Americans, he tended to, I think his instinct was to go along and believe what they were saying. But when he gets to Idaho and at the internment camp, he quickly realizes that, or comes to the conclusion that there's just no disloyalty here. Mm-hmm. And that, right. It's not subtle. Like when the army eventually allows Japanese Americans to volunteer to fight for the country that has just sort of massively incarcerated them based on nothing more than their ethnicity, Japanese Americans sign up like crazy and they go and fight and win all these honors. And so there was he quickly feels like he arrives there, I think, in September, and by December he just wants to get out. He's supposed to be kind of advocating for them in little ways, but he really has no power to do anything, and right. He's working with people who are essentially locked up. So then he transfers to Cleveland, and I think he lives there for a couple of years, and there's a new policy that allows Japanese Americans to be released from the internment camps if they can find jobs and housing in England. And so his job, Ross's task, is to convince landlords and employers in Cleveland to agree to rent to and hire Japanese Americans.
Right.
And again, it's not exactly organizing, but it certainly is learning how to deal with people.
Right.
Because you're essentially going to landlords or employers and saying, the people that like recently we thought were so dangerous, they had to be locked up. Would you like them working for you, or you want to rent houses to them? So it was not an easy task. But he found ways to be effective and to lean on people. And I think that again, he was remembered as, and the reports kind of show him, just kind of working around the clock to try to convince people and leaning on people and finding ways in which he could kind of game the system to get Japanese Americans into even, some of the best jobs are defense related in these war related plants, munitions plants. And technically many of the Japanese Americans aren't supposed to be working there, but he finds ways to work around these restraints to get them those jobs. And at one point, which this is, fun to discover, they actually get into some trouble because the Japanese Americans at some of these jobs that are working in plants related to war production get into trouble because they're working so hard.
Oh,
and
yes.
All the white workers kind of start complaining to their boss saying, these new workers are are making them look bad. And so Ross calls them in and essentially says, you know, just look to your person to your left or right and work as fast as them.
Right.
Don't go any faster. And as Ross recalls, they kind of look at him, you know, sort of downfunded. They hear there's this war going on. They're trying to win this war, and they're being told to work more slowly. So I think for me, that was it's a period that I never knew very much about.
Mm-hmm.
And the perspective of Ross as someone who's kind of this person on the ground, right in the middle of a lot of that, and who left a trail, was really great to try to recover.
Gotcha. And as I recall too, it shows his work with the War Relocation Authority and his earlier work with the SRA. I think it shows his ability to be changed by those that he worked with. And what I mean by this is initially, you mentioned that when he's working with the SRA, he's kind of, you know, handing out checks, and initially he thinks it's a really good thing to do, and he eventually learns that some people are gaming the system, and he gets embittered by that. And then he sits down and talks to, some of these migrants and gets, I think what you state here, a fuller three-dimensional picture of people, that it's neither the case that either the people on the left make that all these, workers and migrants are type of idealist type peoples that, you know, are very deserving of, you know, any, help and assistance and total victims of a system. But also, nor is the right side of it true, in that, these people are just lazy and destitute and inept. So that's the lesson from the SRA. And he starts to, again, sit down and learn from people, really, listening to them and see them as full, whole human beings. And the WRA does this as well. Cause initially, I believe, if I recall this correctly, he was, although not a war hawk by any means, he did, although feel that it was necessary for the Japanese to be interned in some way. He kind of accepted that, argument initially, but as you've just been explaining, as he worked with these people and he saw their loyalty and their work ethic and all the things that they were willing to do, he did see, you know, the very deep problems with the program and saw it to be, you know, full of just immorality, and it was unjust, and that it had really grown out of this hysteria. But what I appreciated again from that was to see Ross's ability to change his position in that way, right? Understand by his working with people that initially maybe his initial assessments you were wrong, and then that influenced him moving forward.
Yeah, that's right. You know, it's a good point. It's also he got really close to what was quote unquote the problem too. So these weren't abstract things. He wanted to, when he was about his time handing out relief checks, he was being told that, in fact, maybe some of what he was doing was creating this chronic dependency, that by handing out relief checks, it was, you know, encouraging laziness among these farm workers, and that if they were just sort of buckled down a little bit more, they could earn enough that they wouldn't be dependent on the government to help cover their costs, that, their basic needs. And so he learns, you know, that, and I think it's an important part of his kind of life, and shows his in some ways unorthodox methods he sometimes uses, but he learns that some of the folks that he's driving around in the fields and sees that some people working in the fields are the same people that he's been handing checks to who have said they can't find work.
Mm-hmm.
And that really, he gets pissed off, and when people say they can't find work, you start taking them right to the carrot fields, which there was always, I guess as he tells it, there was always a need for more people in the carrot, harvesting carrots that paid poorly, and so he'd drive them off of there to work. But then some people made so little still, even working in the carrots, that they qualified for various relief. And so he decides that that there must just be, like, you know, not working hard enough in the fields. And so he goes and works in the fields one day, that I think he hopes to show that, in fact, if you buckle down, you can come back with a decent paycheck. And I think he works like 12 hours or something, and comes home with like 84 cents or something,
right,
you know,
right.
And gone is kind of his talk about chronic dependency. So
exactly.
it wasn't like he just fought through the issue a lot, and that's how he came to the, you know, he really went for the Japanese Americans. He's working directly with people. He's kind of, he wants to go out and figure out what's going on in some level. And I think that helps, that shows to his, that kind of curiosity that he's not satisfied, I think, with just things being abstract arguments. He wants to get close to whatever the action is.
Right. And so with these New Deal type and wartime organizations, this really establishes a foundation for, as you put it here and organize the book, of Ross's education. And then in the post-war period, he then makes the move to, you know, be more of an organizer and an activist, and particularly amongst the population that it becomes most known for working with, that is Mexican Americans, of whom he had very, you know, brief and just little, I think, experience, you know, with previously, you know, either during, you know, during the 30s and 40s. So can you tell us a bit about, you know, this transition of, you know, how he, you know, pivots after World War II from, you know, working with, you know, New Deal and wartime type, you know, organizations, to getting more involved in, you know, as an activist and particularly with the Mexican American communities?
Yeah, again, it's sort of he learns from other people and learns from his situation, his experiences, that he gets hired with a group called American Council on Race Relations, and they're based out of Chicago, and essentially their mission is to try to, you know, it's nebulous, but it's to improve race relations in the country. And there there was a lot of, as there always is, but maybe an especially large amount of sort of tension and turmoil in the post-World War II period, because you have African Americans and Latinos and Mexican Americans who have gone and fought in World War II for democracy, and now they're coming back and they're finding the situation not changed. And Ross gets hired to go work in Southern California by this group to in the area of the Citrus Belt, Inland Empire, Riverside County, San Bernardino, Santa Ana, Orange County, to try to essentially build kind of committees of multi-ethnic, multiracial committees that can in some way work towards improving race relations among Mexican Americans and whites, but also African Americans as well. And he very quickly loses, I think, a lot of interest in building these committees, which tend to be, I think, from his experiences, dominated by kind of well-meaning liberal whites who don't really want to who are happy to help as long as it doesn't like cause any sort of tension or conflict.
Right.
And in fact, the questions that they're dealing with, that he's working on, they end up working on, from school segregation, voter registration, Latino political power, you know, these are controversial, and they're the kind of issues that kind of by definition will create and encounter resistance. And one of the people, there's two people that he at this period, he calls it his organizing toddling period, I guess, with that he credits as being important. One is a sociologist at the University of Redlands named Ruth Tuck,
right,
who has just written a book about the Mexican-American community in San Bernardino, called Not With a Fist, I believe, and then who kind of encourages him to look at the fact that Mexican American community is growing, but they're sort of politically out of the loop. They're not engaged. They're easily abused. They're not super well organized. And another person is Ignacio Lopez, mm-hmm. who's a publisher of a newspaper, but also kind of an activist he was an activist, and he used his newspaper as kind of as a tool for his activism. And both of them kind of convince Ross in some way that Mexican Americans are have the potential, he's also in these towns that are, you know, where the racism and discrimination is so overt, You know, you have, you know, cemeteries that won't bury Mexican Americans. You have schools that are segregated. You have swimming pools. Like, I think it was in Orange where they had one day of the week was Mexican Day, and that was the day where kids of Mexican descent could swim in the pool.
Right.
And that would be like a Monday, and then on Monday night they would drain the pool entirely and refill it with clean water so that white kids wouldn't get, you know, infected by the water they had touched. So, you know, it's the injustices are very stark. And what Ross does, and this is the years 1946, 1947, is he kind of sets aside this, the idea of working with these multi-ethnic committees of kind of that he thought didn't have the stomach for a fight, and instead went out and organized Black and Latino parents and farm workers in these little communities. And over the course of a couple, 2 years, they one group, he runs this, helps develop this really effective kind of voter registration and get out the vote campaign in Riverside, and throws out, they're able to throw out a city council person. Another place they help, you know, desegregate a school or two. And that period, he finishes that, maybe it was a year and a half of organizing for the group ACRR, who aren't thrilled with what he's doing because it's generating a fair amount of controversy.
Right.
The ACRR saw their role kind of as being a consultant, writing reports. They didn't see it as someone who would go in and help organize a community to overthrow an elected official or, you know, embarrass politicians and hold protests. And so soon Ross is being followed by, you know, the FBI opens a file on him, and that big growers organization starts following them around, accusing him of being a communist, which he was not. But that period is important both in terms of, I think, what they're able to accomplish, but also convincing Ross that the people that are going to be able to push, that he really wants to focus on, first to convince them that Mexican Americans, you know, have an incredible potential politically, and that they're being unjustly discriminated against, and secondly that it's the people most directly affected by the issues who are the ones who, as he finds, are going to stand up and fight back and aren't going to be as afraid. It's not going to necessarily be the most politically connected folks in the neighborhood who maybe have businesses that they feel like they could be vulnerable to be boycotted or whatever. I'm talking about like Latinos there. He's, but it's going to be the farm worker. It's going to be the laborer, the folks who feel kind of the sting most acutely, who are going to be the ones pushing through changes. He never reconsiders that position. That remains his position for the next, you know, however many decades he's organizing, that you have to go down to the base and find people directly affected. Very little confidence in the ability of sort of well-connected people at the top to push anything through.
No, exactly. That definitely seems to be a lesson that he came out of this period with, you know, a distrust for organizational structures. And from then on, he was always very apprehensive about being involved with anything that talked about, you know, building coalitions between organizations. As you mentioned, he was much more inclined from these experiences once he met people that, you know, as he, you know, applied the two previous lessons he learned, which was to listen and take time to get to know people. Once he did that, he realized these people were, one, keenly aware of course, the issues they were facing and had ideas about what to do about it. And he was just able to literally provide that little bit of as the title implies, a little bit of a fire underneath them and point them in certain directions, you know, by organizing, as you say here, these, you know, get out the vote campaigns, voter registration campaigns. And that's something that would continue throughout the rest of his organizing, right? After his work in the citrus region from Riverside to Orange County, he moves on to LA, where he gets involved with the organization that really he's perhaps best well known for, which is the Community Services Organization. So you talk a little bit about that. I mean, the real meat of the book is, you know, the middle chapters, and they cover a lot of this. And this is, of course, where Chavez comes into the picture. So will you talk more about, you know, what he, what he, you know, learns from this work, what he does, and you know, how he changes also during this time while working particularly with the community service organization or the CSO.
Yeah, so he leaves some of his time in Orange County and Riverside County and some work in San Diego too, I think, convinced that he's doing what he really wants to be doing. And he links up with, he ends up kind of being let go from the organization he's with, but he links up his work, gets to Saul Alinsky, the organizer and writer out of Chicago who wrote Rules for Radicals and Reveille for Radicals. And he comes out and meets Ross, and immediately they kind of hit it off. They see things more or less the same way. And Alinsky wants to bring Ross to organize maybe in Montana, and Ross is set on organizing by now in Los Angeles, in particular in East Los Angeles, which is, you know, it's a much bigger stage, many more people, but similar issues. And so he convinces Alinsky to hire him to work in East LA and try to build a political organization there, political in terms of power, not political in terms of like a party. And so he arrives again at a really sort of important moment. A young man named Edward Roy Ball had just run for city council, and against sort of an elderly opponent, and had lost pretty badly in a district that included the neighborhood of Boyle Heights, but also parts of downtown. And part of the reason that they blamed the loss was to the fact that so many of his kind of natural constituency, which were the Mexican Americans, were not registered to vote. And so Ross links up with kind of the remnants of that campaign, and which there's still, you know, it's just some family members, some friends, some people that still kind of want to stay involved, and ends up becoming sort of an organizer for their group, which they call the Community Service Organization. It's an extremely boring name, and I think that was intentional because it was also an extremely sort of sensitive period in which to be organizing. You know,
exactly.
You have the McCarthy era, and you have all this, and you already have like parts of the East LA being declared, so you know, naturally kind of subversive. And so this again, and when you look at Ross, his work in building the CSO from East LA and then taking it and help build it statewide, he's operating at a time in which what he's doing, which is essentially trying to build, help encourage the development of Mexican American political power, is controversial and is seen with, you know, there's reason to think it's, for a lot of people, think it's subversive. So he's very conscious of trying to, how he portrays his work as kind of an Americanization campaign of describing. And I think CSO, the term Community Service Organization, is comes out of that sort of wanting to position the work you do in a less threatening way. But in East LA, he kind of takes what he had learned in, especially in Riverside, when he does this get out the vote campaign, and recruits and works with a lot of the local leaders and people that are really motivated to try to change East LA, or try to change LA, to try to get the city power structure to pay attention to them, to try to tackle issues like police brutality and segregated housing and the lack of a political voice. And in 1947, Edward Roy Ball, who had run for city council, had been beat really easily. In 1949, he runs again, and by now Ross and many other people have created a community service organization chapter in East LA, actually a couple of them, that is really a grassroots machine. They've got people knocking on doors, they've got people holding house meetings and living rooms, and he's got like index cards of, you know, 10,000 people with Spanish surnames to call that are registered to make sure they get out the vote. He's organized. They've got like cars going and picking people up to voting places. And so when Roy Ball runs in 49, he crushes his opponent, the same guy who he had lost to before. And it was, I think it was an important victory, not just because it put Roy Ball on a stage in which he could advocate for people and for issues that often were ignored, but also as kind of a wake-up call to the city, that there's a new group in town and that you have to start paying attention to us. In fact, soon after the election, the mayor of L.A. Arranges to come out to East L.A. to meet with leaders of the CSO, in which they kind of berate him for not taking their charges of police brutality seriously. But it's an important campaign. And again, you know, the CSO shifts after Roy Ball is elected to focus on police brutality in a big way, and they win this one kind of big case called Bloody Christmas, in which some cops, not some, like maybe 50 of them, had beaten a group of Latino and a few white kids sort of savagely in the jail. And the CSO helps kind of blow that case, take the case public, and it leads to cops getting jail sentences. So by the time that Ross, but the whole time that they're doing this, they're also not able to really, you know, financially pay for the work. You know, Ross, right, is as good as he is as an organizer, he's a terrible fundraiser, and he also has very little interest, which might explain part of his lack of, but he never really learns how to raise money. So the funds run out, and he ends up moving to San Jose, Northern California. And he still has this dream. He gets another job, but he's not so into it. But he still has this dream of, which I think he's had for a few years now, of taking the CSO and turning what they had done in East LA into, you know, bringing it to other cities and towns and barrios and around the state of California, and really linking them up. And that's when he meets, he moves to Northern California in 52. In June of 1952, he's shifted to working in East San Jose, more or less trying to do what he did in East LA, and that's where he kind of famously knocks on the door of, who's brought to the door of Cesar Chavez, who at that point is, I think he's 25, working part-time at a lumberyard, growing family, but eventually is kind of the vision that Ross lays out of building the political power of Mexican Americans across the state is very enticing and exciting to Chavez. Mm-hmm. And he naturally kind of Ross becomes sort of his mentor, and then they get some funds to actually hire Chavez, and so Chavez goes on the payroll of CSO, or of the Industrial Areas Foundation, technically, which is the money that's coming through Saul Alinsky in Chicago.
Right.
And from 52, when Chavez and Ross first meet, and then I think 53, Chavez becomes a full-time organizer with the CSO, for most of the next decade until 62, when Chavez leaves to go on this what seemed like a crazy quest to organize a union of farm workers, they are in motion around the state of California developing chapters of the community service organization and registering people to vote, getting people to become citizens so they can register to vote, getting them to vote, taking on police brutality, and then even more basic level, like getting streets paved, getting stoplights and stop signs installed. And out of the CSO, out of that decade of work, come a lot of, very important folks, not just Cesar Chavez, but 3 years later, after they meet in 1955, Ross bumps into Dolores Fernandez, who will soon become Dolores Huerta. Right. At a meeting in Stockton, and sort of she again is totally down for the cause. You know, it's not like he has to convince Chavez or Huerta that there are problems, but he's sort of providing an example, a path for ways in which people could could do something about this problem. So she is planning on a career in teaching and instead becomes sort of gets consumed with the CSO. And there are a whole number of other folks in areas from all the way, you know, Raleigh, all of Central Valley, Delano, Bakersfield, Fresno, all these places that where you have these leaders sort of coming out of the CSO in these chapters. And that, you know, that was, I think, the point for Ross bumping into Caesar and sort of mentoring Caesar was probably his, what he considered his proudest moment. But I think it's, you know, the CSO, he really gave, you know, a good part of his life to building the CSO. And by the time he leaves the CSO, and I think it's 1963, it sort of started going down. It is going down. It's not as vibrant. Chavez has left because he wants to organize farm workers on his own, and he doesn't think the CSO has, he thinks it's become too middle class and too sort of reformist, and they don't have the fight that he has to. And so Ross leaves the CSO in 63, and you know, it's sort of a down period for him, because it seems like it's kind of falling apart, and it does quickly lose a lot of its immediate relevance, but out of it grows then the United Farm Workers and Chavez and Huerta and all these other leaders that come out of that. And I think it's I don't know exactly why the CSO hasn't got a lot of attention. Mm-hmm. You know, it might be that it's just not as exciting at the time as United Farm Workers, or it's got a boring name, or the period, or but for me it was really great to be able to try to recreate some of the excitement and to interview these CSO members who are in their 80s and can recall with, you know, with much excitement sort of going to the office and demanding that they, you know, be allowed to register to vote, and going with groups of people and for the first time sort of turning the tables on people who for so long had abused them. And so I think it's an important period to kind of, and I try to tell this story, but I think there's a lot more work to do there about many more angles to cover and more things to unearth about to tell the full story of the CSO.
Yeah, no, certainly. It's and pieces of the CSO have been discussed in, you know, a variety of books now. I think particularly over the last dozen or so years, there have a number of, you know, monographs have come out that have featured, you know, a chapter of the CSO or parts of it in its story. But certainly you're right. I mean, at one point, I think the CSO had about three dozen chapters stretched out throughout California. They were certainly the largest Mexican-American organization in California, the most active at a point, and the most successful. I mean, the issues that are discussed are, you know, challenging, you know, everything from very, what would at the time was seen as very radical stuff, like, you know, challenging police brutality and actually winning cases, the first cases, right, against the LA Police Department for police brutality. And then, you know, other things like, you know, conducting major voter registration drives and supporting John F. Kennedy in his election, and also, you know, influencing a series of local and regional elections. And then just the basic stuff that they did to improve their communities, to, you know, get streets paved, you know, street lights put up, all these things. And so certainly I think for a good period of time there, from, you know, from its founding and you know, at the end of 49, you know, and throughout the 50s, there are certainly perhaps the most progressive and active Mexican-Americanist organization around. And so, as you mentioned, there's going to be, hopefully, I know there's work coming out on it soon. So certainly there's definitely a lot more to be told and discussed about the CSO. But you know, you cover quite a bit of it. There are certainly things, I mean, I'm kind of a, you know, nerd in that aspect of it. The CSO has attracted my interest for quite a while. And so I was pleased to learn quite a few things from what you cover through Ross's perspective in organizing them statewide. So we're coming short on time, but let's talk a little bit before we wrap up here about Ross and Chavez and the UFW. Particularly, can you tell us a bit about what was Ross's involvement in with the UFW? I guess I'll leave it at that, and I'll let you answer that question, and as well as how his relationship evolved with Chavez during that time.
Yeah, so it's probably easiest to think of it as two phases that Ross has, or two roles he plays at the UFW. When Chavez asked him to come back and work for the union, it's in the midst of a really important campaign where the UFW is going up against the Teamsters and a large grower called DiGiorgio, and they have an election, a union election that they, Chavez feels they have to win, that if they don't win, it will call into question everything they've always said about their union, which is that if you give farm workers the chance to vote to join the UFW, at the time it was what became the UFW, the National Farm Worker Association, or different names, if you give them a chance to vote for the union, they will vote for it. And so this was the first real election in 1966 that they're having, where they're going up against the Teamsters and against the grower, and the Teamsters are friendly with the grower. And if they lose that election, Chavez and Ross and a lot of people kind of felt like it would be disastrous, because here they are, they got what they wanted, they have an election, and look, if they lose, the growers and everyone can say, look, they don't even, the people they say they've been working with for so long, that they're channeling their anger and about the injustice, don't even want to be on there, don't even want them. And so Ross helps directs that campaign, the DiGiorgio campaign, and they win. And through that, for the next couple of years, 1966, from about 66 to 70 or so, he's really in the midst of a lot of, right in the middle of what's going on. The boycott develops with the UFW, it develops and expands nationwide. He's going out to New York City to help develop it. There are strikes. He's training a lot of the people and interacting with a lot of people who become key leaders of the UFW, like Eliseo Medina, Marshall Gantz, and then out of around 1970, so the UFW wins their 5-year kind of strike and boycott, and the grape companies all come to the table and sign agreements, sign contracts, and then in 1970. And then there is another fight over the lettuce growers, and that becomes a large strike, and they win a lot. The UFW wins a lot of new contracts as well. But the latter half of the 70s, Ross really shifts. By now he's in his 60s, and he shifts to becoming more of a trainer and kind of someone that Chavez will call on for special projects, but really spends much of his time going around the country training UFW volunteers who, you get as a UFW volunteer or boycott volunteer, you're getting $5 a week, and you have a place to usually crash, like at a boycott house, and you're trying to convince people not to buy grapes or lettuce, and get people active on picket lines and in front of grocery stores, and so Ross is really becomes sort of a one man training school,
right,
taking all the things he has sort of learned during his career and training thousands of people, and that's interesting and important, I think, too, because at that period, the unions. Many unions are not very engaged in organizing, and the UFW is doing really exciting stuff around organizing. And Ross, I found that I've had two organizing jobs, one at a community group in Brooklyn, one at a labor union, and at both places, just by chance, the people who were kind of running the show were trained by Ross.
Wow.
In the 70s and came out of the UFW, and so I think that's an important part of his legacy as well, just that there were a lot of people that sort of, that went through a Ross type school.
Right.
And, actually in Brooklyn, we ran a campaign that involved house meetings, which was a very raw, a technique mm-hmm. that raw became very, became kind of his signature. And we used house meetings on a lead poisoning campaign in Brooklyn. And so I was, the person who took us through that campaign had been trained by Ross at the UFW in the 70s, but I didn't realize that. So I was, you know, it's a strange position. I'm writing a book about someone who, in, whose techniques I had used without even realizing it years ago, which I think speaks again to the breadth and depth in some ways of his life. And, you know, at a certain point, the UFW starts, for various reasons, starts, you know, Chavez makes a series of destructive decisions, and people start dropping out, other people are forced out, and Ross doesn't have a role in some of that, but a lot of it he's just kind of watching from the side, and his relationship with Chavez, I don't know how much they're actually interacting in the later period mm-hmm. when they certainly were extremely close in the 60s and in the early 70s and mid 70s when there are crises that Chavez would call on Ross to get his input or to ask him to, you know, we need to go train these, we've got a big election coming up in Coachella, can you go out and train some folks, whatever. I'm not sure how involved, I don't think he's very involved or has too much communication with Chavez when there are some, you know, not so nice things happening at the union, and a lot of the folks that Ross thought were some of the best people are leaving. And I don't think Ross talked about that much. I mean, I know he didn't. I talked to everyone that he would have talked to, and they said he basically, I think his relationship with Chavez evolved to the point where he didn't feel maybe that it was his place to criticize him publicly or privately, and that you know, Ross was the person who you know showed up at Chavez's door one day and you know, set him down the path in some ways of being an organizer, and so he had a privileged position, I think, his relationship to Chavez, but he never. At least as far as I could tell, really questioned the moves that Chavez made. He had an incredible loyalty to Chavez, and he would put most things in front of that, and he would put everything else sort of behind that, and remained loyal to Chavez to the end. And by loyal, I mean he not just that he saw Chavez as a great labor leader and all these things, of course he was, but that he was unable to bring himself to criticize some moves that I think if anyone else had been doing these, some of the things that Chavez did, Ross would have been the first to sort of go to that person and say, bad move. But for Chavez, he didn't go there.
Yeah, no, that was certainly interesting. And it was something that it was a part of the book that I was very eager to get to. And I guess the only thing I can say is it still kind of, as you've stated here, it still kind of remains a mystery as to, you know, again, towards the late 70s as the series of purges are happening in the union and things happen that make Ross uncomfortable. He's aware of them. They make him uncomfortable, but he's not on the board. And you're right. So because he's not on the board and because he's, you know, he was perhaps always working with the union as, you know, in a consulting-like position and going out and training, you're right. I think both his admiration for Chavez, and he recognized that no one had sacrificed as much for the union as Chavez. And it's just a mixture of all these complicated things that perhaps came together and made it difficult for him to ever really push back, you know?
The thing that you can kind of say conclusively is that, you know, he didn't talk about it to the people he was close to, like mm-hmm. for example, his son. He never would, you know, would bear criticisms of various things. But also that he didn't believe there were a number of people that were, you know, there were these very militant lettuce workers who worked really hard, great organizers, in Salinas that, Chavez came to see sort of as a threat to his power and orchestrated to have them more or less kicked out of the union, and that they were seen as this, portrayed as this negative force trying to subvert the union. And Ross certainly, I think, did not believe that. He worked with a lot of the people that left the UFW who were accused of being disloyal or having plots to subvert the union. He had no problem working with them in different contexts. So I think he did not believe that the threats as described by Chavez and some of the Chavez followers, I don't think he thought they were real. And there's kind of this painful irony, which is that Ross had always believed that, you know, you have to kind of go down to the base and find the people who are most affected and have them. And by the end, the people that are willing, you know, really doing the work and driving the organizing, especially these lettuce workers in Salinas, they're the ones that are being told they don't have a place in the union of which they're, you know, so passionately for and have been sort of fighting for. And so I think there's this like painful, it must have been painful at some level for Ross to see that some of these militant workers, there wasn't a place for them.
Right. Right. And well, you tell us again, I appreciate how much time you spent with us today. Could you wrap up, maybe we can wrap things up by just telling us a bit about what Ross did after I don't think it's really ever said that he ever left the union per se, but he moved on, right? Or Chavez didn't lean on him as much after, you know, the late 70s and in particular the 81 convention when there was this big split that happens and the union kind of goes in a different, you know, direction. So can you tell us a bit, what does Ross do afterwards, and maybe just that points to, you know, his bigger legacy? A lot of these things we've talking about, you know, the number of people that he just was able to touch and train and went on to do other work and found many, many other organizations. Maybe we can have a closing comment on that.
Yeah, so he continues until, you know, his later years, he's living in this kind of primitive one-room cabin, sleeping on a mattress on the floor, doesn't have, you know, doesn't really have any savings, but he's continues to be active training organizers and training groups for everything from like the Farm Labor Organizing Committee, which is was working on launching a campaign against Campbell's Soup Company. He was working with a group called Jobs for Peace, working on nuclear freeze, working with his son. His son had worked with an organization called Neighbor to Neighbor, which was working to stop the flow of military aid to El Salvador.
Mm-hmm.
And so he kind of spends his later years lending his services and sort of his own brand of organizing, training people in a bunch of different around a bunch of different causes and a bunch of different organizations. And he doesn't really slow down too much until Alzheimer's. He develops Alzheimer's, and so that really is what keeps him from continuing to organize. And during this period as well, he's trying to get his writings into. He's been working on this, you know, quote unquote, the book for decades now. And he's trying to, with the help of some folks, get his writings organized and together. But that's really how he spends his 80s is he never, whereas Chavez, I think, soured a little bit on organizing or got interested in other things like building an intentional community and mm-hmm. turning the UFW into more than a union. Ross really never tires mm-hmm. of organizing. And I don't mean organizing like all the romantic things that you think of when you think of like organizing and social justice. I mean like teaching people how to use the phone effectively or knock on right. doors or having house meetings. He loves the stuff. He loves the stuff that from people like Saul Alinsky, it would have bored them to tears, but he never loses faith or never becomes kind of cynical. Which I think it's just because he thinks that organizing is both very important and it works But I think, you know, for his, you know, his and on one level, the legacy is just kind of like, I mean, there's a legacy of the people that he trains and the people that come out of it and the way in which they shape and continue to shape, you know, shape the past and continue the UFW with, you know, the people that came out of the UFW and Chavez sort of showing that farm workers could be organized into a powerful union, and people have taken the lessons of connecting the farm worker struggle to consumer issues, running the most. So there's a whole sort of generations of folks who I think he touched in some way, and can, you know, through his organizing, sort of his influence has seeped out, sometimes unacknowledged, but often there. And then there's, you know, for me, having spent a few years as an organizer and having a kind of very personal, I guess, understanding in my own mind of how hard it is and how sometimes it just feels like, what are we doing here? Roth, I think you look at someone like Roth and it's just, you know, sometimes you win. Sometimes, like, this is how it always is. There's never a blueprint. There's never, like, you know, if you had a blueprint and you had guaranteed success, then if you're looking for that in 1962, well, Chavez is not going to go out with no guaranteed income and move to Delano and try to do what no one has ever done before. And so I think when I think about the legacy or what I take from having spent a few years trying to learn everything I could about Roth is that, you know, organizing sometimes works, and it works in a way that is sort of deep, that can be deep, that can really shape people's lives and, you know, have people act in ways that which they thought were previously might have thought were impossible. So that's sort of what I take from Ross. Is there's a cautionary tale too, because he prioritized his organizing over everything, including, you know, his family and his wife and his kids, and so he's sort of maniacal in his devotion to organizing. So it's not just a happy story, but I do think it's remarkable that the things that you can do when you get other people involved.
Certainly, and I think in that untiring dedication to his work, him and, you know, Chavez were just, you know, it seems that they came from the two peas from the same pod or something. You know, they came from the same root in that type of way. They were both just able to completely, as you mentioned, kind of maniacally focus on organizing. And that statement you were mentioning that Ross said, I think is really important. You know, that he says, you know, sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. Essentially, what they were trying to do were these very, you know, tough things that were literally trying to overturn institutions. And so then the question is, well, what are you going to do tomorrow, right? And he just had this undying, you know, dedication. And I think he really, he was really convinced, you know, in the power of people, you know, that if once organized, you know, that people could really work in a democratic way and be, you know, to benefit themselves, you know, and to make decisions for themselves. And that seems that is certainly something in all of his work that he never shied away from. He didn't ever, even with, you know, as you mentioned, the ups and downs of the organizing with the CSO, at one point it was at a peak, and then through a number of issues, it kind of fizzled out. And then you had the UFW and it takes off, and they had these tremendous victories. And then, you know, it kind of went its ways, but he never lost, it doesn't seem like he ever lost faith and lost really that belief, that core belief in the power of people to function democratically, to improve, you know, themselves. You know, without the need of bringing in outside organizations, outside people necessarily to do that for them. It was just a matter of organizing the people, showing them a few things what to do, and then they could do it on their own.
Yeah, it was very sturdy. It wasn't like someone who abstractly believed, like, yes, power to the people. People together can do things, and they go out, and it all falls apart, and they're like, oh, I'm never trying that again. Yeah,
right.
he spent his life doing that, and he saw things crumble over and over again. But I think there was just, you know, there was this kind of optimism that this was, what he was meant to be doing, and that occasionally things got slightly better. And man, what better way to spend your life than occasionally making things slightly better? As limited as that might seem, it works, and those breakthroughs sometimes blast. And so I think it's also important to remember that he didn't exactly see it as a sacrifice. It was
right. Yeah.
It was what he really loved to do. So
certainly. Hey, well, Gabriel, thanks again for your time and coming on to New Books in Latino Studies. And as I said, I know there are many that have eagerly awaited this biography and are going to be anxious to read it. And so I encourage our listeners to do that. Go out and get a copy of the book and have a look at it. And Gabriel, thanks again for your time.
Oh, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks for tuning in to New Books in Latino Studies. I'm David James Gonzalez, the host of the podcast, and I hope you've enjoyed my conversation today with Gabriel Thompson, author of America's Social Arsonist, Fred Ross and Grassroots Organizing in the 20th Century, published by the University of California Press in 2016. I'd love to hear your feedback and comments on today's podcast or suggestions for future ones. You can feel free to contact me at newbooksinlatinostudies@gmail.com. You may also rate and comment on the podcast through iTunes and Twitter and Facebook. Thank you.